Well, we'd like to start on time as our custom here. Good evening and welcome to the second presentation in this, our 15th series of talks on faraway places with strange sounding names, sponsored by the Friends of WKU Libraries. My name is Brian Kutz, and as head of the Department of Library Public Services at WKU, I coordinate this series with my colleague Peggy Wright, who's at home recovering from surgery, and with assistance from our webmaster taking pictures, Haiwan Wan. Ryan Dowell and Christopher McConnell designed our posters, and our technical specialist is Shadden Melke. Our speaker tonight is a native of Terre Haute, Indiana, where her family has lived for several generations and where she attended schools. Growing up, she wanted to be someone with the ability to travel and was influenced by television, books, and movies about all the world's interesting places. She received her BA in interior design and MA in counseling from Indiana State University and worked in student affairs administration in universities in the upper Midwest. In 1993, she entered the Graduate School of Marquette University, from where she received an MA and PhD in European history for her research on women, crime, and work in London from 1783 to 1815. She taught at the University of Wisconsin-Milwaukee and the University of Wisconsin-Stout before joining the History Department at Murray State University, where she is currently the interim chair and teaches classes in European, British, and women's history. Her research interests include women and their lives, and she explores this theme in her fascinating article, Women Who Kill, an analysis of cases in late 18th century and early 19th century London, published last year in the Journal of Social History. Her interest in Scotland began while teaching in the Celtic Studies program at the University of Wisconsin-Milwaukee. She's visited there 7 times, and in 2009 spent 9 weeks teaching women's history classes as part of the Experience Scotland program. Tonight's talk focuses on the lives and work of 2 Scottish duchesses, Anne Hamilton, Duchess of Hamilton, and Anna Scott, Duchess of Buccleuch. Making her very first visit to Bowling Green, please give a warm welcome to Kathy Callahan. Kathy.
Thank you for having me this evening. I drove over from Murray today and managed to get lost in Russellville for a few minutes and managed to extricate myself from Russellville, and here I am, so I'm very happy to be here. I still don't know exactly how I did it, but they didn't have me on the bypass, and I went through town, and I don't know. Well, in 2006, I made my first trip to Scotland, and I wasn't sure what to expect. I'd lived in London and knew that Scotland was nothing like London. And so I went there with students. I had an opportunity to experience my first visit guiding a group of students. So it was fortunate that I had a teaching partner for that program, but I went there once and I can't get enough of it. And so I'm going to talk about some of the things that have captured my attention. And one of the things are the women in the aristocracy that I've been spending a lot of time looking at. And 2 women have caught my attention, part of which because Anna Scott, the Duchess of Buccleuch, is the woman on the right here, and she owns a house that students that I've worked with in a program called Experience Scotland, they live in her old house. And so I'll show you some photographs of that as we move through the program. But living in someone's house gives you a feeling that you know them a little bit because you have this opportunity to see how they've designed the home because she rebuilt it from a castle. The kinds of surfaces that she chose, it's filled with beautiful native wood and Italian marble, and it's quite a stunning place even today, over 300 years later. But I'll tell you a little bit more about the Duchess of Buccleuch and then Anne Hamilton, her contemporary, who lived in Western Scotland. Now, when I have looked at these women, I noted that both of them had books written about them. Anna Scott, the Duchess of Buccleuch, has a book written by Maurice Lee, a Rutgers University professor, but he only covers her life to the end of her first marriage. And the second woman, Anne Hamilton, has had a very good book written about her family, and that's called The Days of Duchess Anne, written by Rosalind Marshall, who is from Scotland. She's retired now. But these two works, to me, weren't satisfactory enough. There's more to these women than I think either of those treatments give us the opportunity to understand about them. And there's particularly not a voice that talks about their activity and agency, the kinds of things that they were doing to help themselves and their families. They don't really explore that in the same kind of way that I would. And so that's how I'm going to be looking at them as I continue my research. But my research shows that despite gender norms, at the end of the 17th century, so they lived from the middle part of the 17th century, and both of them survived into the early 18th century. Despite the gender norms of the time period, these women really grabbed a hold of any agency that was available to them and exceeded what most women were able to accomplish. I mean, very, very few women in the history of Scotland in this time period would have been able to claim the opportunity to really manage family estates. Both of these families experienced enormous scandals during the times these women were alive, and they accomplished rising their families out of these scandals by raising their children, maintaining hold of their family finances, by rebuilding family homes, as well as maintaining a very strong Scottish identity. Now, Duchess Anne Hamilton is a little bit easier to get at. Her family's records number in over, there's over 8,000 pieces there at the National Archives in Scotland. In addition, she and her daughter were correspondents with each other regularly, and there's an additional probably 1,000 or so records at Blair Castle in the Highlands of Scotland, and I've had an opportunity to look at both sets of records. Anna Scott, the Duchess of Buccleuch, is a little bit more difficult to get at because her records aren't as public as Anna Scott's and Anne Hamilton's are, and she actually spent most of her life living at London. And furthermore, she's hard to get at because most people don't see her as part of the Scottish elite. She was a duchess in her own right, meaning that she came into that title herself. She didn't get it through marrying anyone. But she lived most of her life in London, so most people associate her with London, but her money and her land was, in fact, in Scotland. Anne Hamilton was born in London in 1632. She returned to Scotland when she was 10 years old. She had not been there before. Her father was the Master of the Horse and Commissioner for Scotland for the King Charles I. And Charles I also elevated her father from Marquis to Duke in 1643. Very concerned about her safety during this time of turmoil in Scotland, and Scotland was experiencing a civil war in the 1640s, concerned for her safety, he decides that she needs to go north. So when she was 10 years old in 1642, she went up to Scotland and lived with her grandmother, and her grandmother, in fact, taught her a lot about how to manage an estate. Following the Bishop's War between Scotland and England and the civil wars of Parliament in England, Parliament decided to have her father executed for his support of Charles I. Her uncle then would be given the dukedom. He inherited that from his brother. And the brother actually would die serving Charles II in Scotland in 1651, when he was actually in exile living on the continent. After Anne Hamilton's uncle died, at the age of 19, she inherited the title. Her uncle had plenty of titles of his own and decided that his children would inherit his lands and his titles, and then the young Duchess should be given the opportunity to regain her family strength and move from there. She immediately, upon the age of 19, decided that she needed to figure out who she was going to marry, because being married was one of her jobs. All right, she needed to be a wife, and she needed to be a mother, and going alone was not going to do anything to her for her family in the long run. She needed a husband. So she began this process, and if we think about this, this is very unusual in the time. She arranges her own marriage. Usually your mother arranges it for you. If your father's still alive, he'll help. If your parents are gone, your grandparents will do that, or an aunt or an uncle. Her closest family relations had perished during Scotland's very violent time, and as a consequence for this, she arranges her own marriage. She married the Earl of Selkirk, who upon their marriage became William the Duke of Hamilton. Now, according to a historian, her name's Katie Barclay, who's done a really nice job looking at aristocratic families, she argues that Anne Hamilton, the Duchess, actually married below herself. She was a Duchess, for crying out loud, and she married an Earl. It's one step down the hierarchy, but, you know, in a time period when that makes a difference, she married below herself. He helped her accomplish many of her goals, including raising money to pay enormous debts that accumulated during the violent times of the Civil War and the Bishops' Wars. And he also helped her accomplish what she knew she needed to do, have children. They had 13 children, and 10 would live to adulthood. And if you just think about 10 children, that's a pretty amazing thing to try and make a way for them in their later life. How are they going to provide for those children? And certainly that would be one of the tasks that family would face as well. Because family estates had fallen into disorder during the wars and during the Commonwealth period that lasted from 1649 until 1660, the couple expended a great amount of time and money to resurrect the family lands. And their lands are located, and we see Hamilton Palace here, which was their primary home. They also spent time in Kinneil House. They were the keepers of Holyrood House, which was the primary residence for the king when he was in Scotland. They owned Lennox Love House, which we'll come back to later, and these other dots, Strathaven, Broadwick Castle, etc., were all part of their holdings. So one could say that they certainly had lots of territory and lots of places to stay or send relatives when they needed to. The Duke's many interests included farming, and I think he's one of the earliest gentleman farmers in Scotland. And his ability to understand how to run a farm effectively is going to be something that really helps sustain the family. They get involved in all kinds of animal husbandry, developing new breeds of plants, etc. And so with his help, they really are able to raise some of their own cash through the sale of crops and piloting different kinds of plants. The couple themselves are also going to involve themselves in a major renovation of the family seat, and that is in Hamilton, Scotland, or was in Hamilton, Scotland, called Hamilton Palace. Now, it was an old castle before this Duke and Duchess got a hold of it, and they renovated it into a very lovely place, the largest castle in Europe at the time. And so before Louis XIV built Versailles, this was the largest place in Europe. The house was finished in 1695, and it was called the Great Design by their secretary, whose name was David Crawford. The Hamiltons hired this man, Scottish architect James Smith, to do the job. Now, because the title of Duke and Duchess actually belonged to Anne and only came to the Duke through Anne, it provided her with loads of opportunities and decision-making opportunities that certainly weren't available to other women, even other aristocratic women. She was essentially the man of the family. Now, she's probably not going to say that in public, but certainly lots of people knew that she controlled the territories, she controlled the family finances, and ultimately she's going to be the person who controls the marriages her children will engage in, which will help increase the family's value, if you will, in terms of the other Scottish aristocrats. One of her major jobs was controlling family finances. And furthermore, She always had the final say on the marriage of her children. And we'll see in just a moment what I mean by that. There are going to be limits on her ability to act. For example, when she pressed lawsuits, and you can imagine the Scottish aristocracy, and I'm sure the same is true for England, they were in court all the time. But whenever they had to go to court to press law cases, she had to have the Duke's permission for that, because essentially, legally, she was a no one. She had become subsumed into her husband's livelihood when they married, so legally she wasn't separate from him, and so he had to press any law cases that go forward. Now this is a photograph from a painting of Duke of Hamilton, and he is responding in this letter to a marriage proposal given to him by someone who wants her daughter to marry his son. And he says in this letter the following: "I hope you do need the justice to believe that I am very sensible of the favor you intended me and my family in that proposition you made of marriage for my son. And as I very well remember the difficulty that now puts a stop to what was spoke to, I think when I told you I feared my wife would strike at it, which I have done all I could to remove, but found her so determined in her opinion that the more she has debated it, the more she was confirmed in her opinion. Your Lord, knowing my estate coming by her, I believe you will not think it reasonable, nor my interest or my son's, to do anything without her request." So he knows which side of the bread the butter sits, and he knows that he has to keep his wife very happy. He is going to live until 1694, and after his death in 1694, Anne Hamilton is going to continue to maintain the title. And that's relatively unusual, because it's the expectation, because she had a son who could inherit the title, it's the expectation that she would pass it to him immediately following his death, her husband's death. She didn't want to be a dowager duchess, which means the widow of a duchess. She wanted the whole pie, all right? But she also knew that her son was a bit of a scoundrel. And here he is. Her eldest son and heir's name was James, and he was known as the Earl of Arran before he became the Duke of Hamilton. And Anne says the following about her son. She says, "He has caused me, quote, many a sore heart." Now, one of the things that we know was difficult for him was paying attention to just about anything except having a good time. I think always a problem of children who have way too much money and nothing but time on their hands, right? And so all he wanted to do was hang out with his friends, which, for example, one of his friends was Charles II. Who doesn't want to hang out with the king? He actually was given the opportunity to travel the continent with a tutor, and did a horrible job learning anything because he was so engaged with his social life. His mother, from his teenage years, was thoroughly disgusted with young James, and that disgust continued to remain with her until his untimely death, which we'll talk about in just a moment. Now, remember, he is supposed to have his mother's permission to marry anyone. And this little bit I'm going to put up gives you an idea about how closely he paid attention to school. Now, in his defense, I will say that the English language wasn't standardized in terms of spelling until the middle of the 18th century. So we'll give him a little bit of a break here, but I think you'll agree that he wasn't a scholar. To acquaint you and your grace, my mother, my father, with my being married, then to do it so now I shall tell you that I have been married man for a quarter of 1 hour. It was in my lord's president's lodging from whence, and I couldn't decipher the word, this, and it was no sooner over than I called for a pen, ink, and paper, that I wait no sooner enter into any other state of life, when that I might begin it, so weak by praying identity to my dearest mother, whose blessings I humbly beg upon what has been done this night. So, rogue son, right? He goes off and marries someone without his parents' permission, and so lots of backpedaling is going to have to take place. So yes, of course we knew about this. Of course we're happy about this. But nonetheless, he sends a letter within 15 minutes after the deed was done. He married for the first time in 1686. Unfortunately, he was widowed in 1690. And he married again in 1698. But one of the interesting things about James is that he was not interested in being married. He loved playing around. He loved sleeping around. He loved drinking. He loved gambling. All those kind of things that aristocratic sons like to do. But his mother kept telling him, if you don't get married again, you will not ever get the title. All right? Now, she could only hold that until she died. But she lived to be in her 80s, and so he knew that he needed to. She still was pretty strong by 1698, and he knew she meant business. So in 1698, he married again, and that marriage, of course, was all but a condition of the Duchess resigning her titles to him. To goad him into marrying, she said, if you marry, I will become the Dowager Duchess, and you and your new wife can be the Duke and Duchess of Hamilton. He complied with his mother's wishes, of course, because then he has the title and a lot more prestige wherever he is. She resigned her titles, but she kept a hold of the purse strings. She knew that he was a real rascal, and to give him hold of the money, he was constantly in debt, to give him hold of the money meant that the family would probably be bankrupt within a short amount of time. So she held on to the money. One of her primary goals was to make sure that their family had representation in Scottish Parliament. As a female, she could not sit in Scottish Parliament, and so until she had named her son Duke, he was not able to sit there. One of the things that was happening in 1698 was great conflict between England and Scotland, and there were already beginning discussions about whether the two crowns should come together. Well, the crowns had already come together, but to link the two parliaments together. Anne Hamilton works very closely with her son as a proposal of union came forward in the early 18th century. It was argued in Scottish Parliament. He was the leader of Scottish Parliament, and this event is going to go very badly for him. He really deeply wanted the union, and his mother did not want the union of parliaments. And so he is going to do everything to delay voting because he doesn't want his mother to know how he really feels about things. And so the day the vote is supposed to happen, he's at Holyrood House Palace in his apartment feigning illness so he doesn't have to go face Parliament and turn down the people that want the union and vote in the way that his mother expects him to vote. His comrades are going to drag him physically from Holyrood House Palace up the hill to Parliament, where he would finally call the meeting, take the vote, and the vote to make a union of the two parliaments was taken in 1707. Anne Hamilton's son, unfortunately, dies in 1712. He dies in a duel in Hyde Park in London, a rascal to the end, one might say. And with his death, his eldest son, who at that time was not even out of his adolescent stage, became the heir apparent to the family dukedom. Well, he actually became the Duke of Hamilton. It was decided that he would move north and live with his grandmother so he could learn about Scotland, distracted by what was going on in the city of London. He could learn how to manage estates, learn to know the people there. And so after 1712, then he would go north and live his life with his grandmother until she passed away. Anne Hamilton was always a patriot, and that was evident in her letters. She regularly wrote about her concern related to her distressed nation, as she said, particularly during the very tumultuous 1690s. In 1700, 8 years after the massacre at Glencoe, and as anti-English sentiment continued to build in Scotland over union, she called the Glencoe event in which many Scots were killed. She called this event murder and expressed belief that it ought to be essentially a national holiday, publicly mourned for the sake of Scotland. Continuing her opposition to England, she disagreed with the proposal for union, as I've already explained, and she engaged in very active dialogue with her family, both in written and spoken form, during the debates. She launched petitions against the union as well. Writing to her daughter Catherine in 1705, she says of Scots who support the Union, quote, "Oh, what a sad day and miserable condition are we brought under, and if it had only been done by enemies, it might have been borne, but to have it done by friends and those who would pass for patriots." In other words, her friends were turning their back on Scotland, and of course her son was one of those men that was involved in that process. The Hamilton House is now at Lennoxlough, which is in Haddington, Scotland, in East Lothian. Hamilton Palace, that was in Hamilton, Scotland, on the west coast, was demolished in 1927 because of numerous structural problems. Coal mining had come so close to the house that it made the ground unstable and it was starting to collapse, and so it was decided to tear down that very elegant place in 1927. Upon her death in 1716, an elegy was written for her. And it says the following: "The main character of a saint we find, a lustry shine in her noble mind, construing well of actions done amiss, and liberal bounty to all in distress. The widows, orphans, poor and fatherless, her grace's hand found hope for their relief, and all she could, she did to assuage their grief." So the Scots in Western Scotland loved Anne Hamilton. I'm not so sure how they felt about her son, but they certainly loved Anne. Her contemporary, Anna Scott, the Duchess of Buccleuch, was born in 1651, but she left Scotland in 1662. And that's almost exactly the opposite of what happens with Anne Hamilton. This woman is born in 1651, and 11 years later she leaves for London, and she's going to spend most of the rest of her life in London, and she won't return to Scotland until 1701. Her father died when she was 3. Her mother quickly remarried. She's one of the only women that I've ever known that has been a duchess 3 times over, because she had 3 different husbands and all were dukes. Her mother remarried. Margaret Leslie, Duchess of Weems, was quite a powerhouse of women herself. One of the things that she decided was that she was going to marry her daughter, who was the heir apparent to the duchy. She was going to marry him off as best she could, and she set her sights on royalty. Margaret Leslie, the Duchess of Weems, arranged for her daughter to marry the illegitimate son of Charles II, James Croft. They married when the children were very young, and I'll explain that in just a moment. And here's a letter from the king explaining what he wants to do. And if you come down to the middle, essentially, he says, "You've offered your daughter, the Countess of Buccleuch, to marry my son. Yay, he's illegitimate. This is a great opportunity. We're taking you up on it." All right? So, Duchess Weems packs up her daughter on a nice carriage, and off they go to London when she was 11 years old. All right, and she would be a child bride in every sense of the word, marrying James Crofts the very next year when she was a bride of 12 and her spouse was 14. Now, to rest assured, they didn't share a bed officially until she was a little older, probably 14 or 15, but nonetheless, a marriage took place when they were both legally able to do so. So now, the Buccleuch family has royalty in it, or at least royal blood, one would say, because James Crofts is the illegitimate son of Charles II. A little interesting fact about Charles II, he had 17 children, all of them illegitimate. He and his wife were unable to have children, but I want you also to rest assured about this. He took very, very good care of them, and virtually all of them had titles, so they were very well taken care of. Now, when Crofts married... When he married Anna Scott. He was required to take her family name. And the exact same thing had happened with the Duchess of Hamilton. Her husband had to take the Hamilton name. And so James Crofts became James Scott. And also upon their wedding day, he became the Duke of Monmouth and Buccleuch. So he had a double dukedom, as his wife Anne would be a double duchess. The marriage, of course, itself, not for the reasons we would think, but the marriage itself was a scandal in Scotland. And it was a scandal because Margaret Weems, the Duchess, is going to maneuver behind everyone's backs, and she's going to arrange this to keep little Anna Scott, the Duchess of Buccleuch, away from an evil uncle who she wanted the evil uncle out of their lives, and one way to do that was to marry the daughter off. The evil uncle wanted his son to marry Anna, and she thought if I can get her a royal betrothal, and if I can take her out of town, then the Buccleuch money and the Buccleuch lands are going to be safe from these evil men who have decided that they have designs on my daughter. So the marriage took place. They were 12 and 14, Anna 12, her husband 14. And certainly one could say that life with James Scott, the Duke of Monmouth and Buccleuch, life was not easy. He was a lot like his counterpart from Scotland, James, the Duke of Hamilton. He was a playboy, and he continued to be playing the field the entire time that he was married to the Duchess. Although all his money came from the Duchess, he used it very effectively in wooing other women. And if he would have had a sports car, I figured it would have been a Porsche or maybe a Jaguar. I don't know. But that was he was in the fast lane. One of his good friends was, in fact, the Duke of Hamilton. The couple lived in London. They lived at Whitehall, and eventually they would own their own house at Moor Park. And they were the it couple in London for several social seasons. Diarist Samuel Pepys commented on their wedding, and he also commented at their appearance at other events in the city of London. King Charles, during his time with his son, had indulged his son so effectively that the young couple very quickly began living beyond their means. Both liked to spend money. They were young and not very bright, I would say. Both of them had also had very limited schooling, but they also were not very mature. And so consequently, they had horrible financial problems. But that is going to be the least of her problems, I think, in the big scheme of things, because he is going to get himself involved in very dangerous politics. And dangerous so much so that eventually he is going to be tried for treason. Now, this is a representative of him, a representation of him when he was fighting the Dutch on his father's behalf. We also know that he was in Scotland. In 1679, he led battles against the Scots that were Covenanters. They were strong Presbyterians and were fighting against the English crown. And so we see here a dashing young man on a white horse, of course, looking very, very snazzy. But he is always playing the field, always spending money, and he had been so indulged, as I said, by his father, that one of the things that happens as his father grew old and infirmed, as he began to fantasize about becoming the king. Illegitimate sons do not become the king, all right? But he was his dad's favorite, and he felt like, gosh, dad's going to break the rules for me, right? Talk about self-obsession, right? I'm going to be able to do something that no one in the history of England or Scotland has ever done before, the illegitimate son that comes to the throne. As Anne matured, she maintained a brisk correspondence with her own stepfather, as well as factors or men who were working for her, including the Earl of Melville. This letter. This is a letter that actually the Duke of Monmouth sends north to Anna Scott's factor, and he says, "Pray let me know how my wife's doing, essentially, with the family business. I hope you will not make so much worry about this. Pray, let me know if my wife begins to look after her business at home and if there be any hopes of her becoming a good Hussein or a good housewife. All right? So is she doing what she is supposed to do in regards to her Scottish lands? Bad things happen to the Duke of Monmouth, and one of the things that he's going to engage in 1679 is he engages in something known as the Rye House Plot, in which he planned to kill his uncle James, the Duke of York, who was the heir apparent to the throne, and his own father. Following that very sad series of events, he goes into exile, and he's going to live in the Dutch Republic for a while. Where he was born. He seeks solace there. He also will find a mistress there, as should come as no surprise. And he is going to be finally tried for treason and executed in 1685. He dies when he tries to overthrow his uncle, who became James II. He led a very ill-fated rebellion that will result in his capture and his incarceration in the Tower of London. So concerned was James II about the security of his crown, and there are lots, and he would end up losing his crown 3 years later. But James was so concerned that he also had James Scott's children locked in the Tower of London as well. They were teenagers, and the youngest was a daughter, Mary, and she actually would die during their incarceration in the Tower. The Duke would be charged with treason. He was if he was found guilty, he would be beheaded because he was a man of the aristocracy. His wife decided she hadn't, Anna Scott, the Duchess of Buccleuch, had not seen her husband James in over a year and a half because he'd been living in exile. She decides that she needs to go to the Tower and get her husband to tell everyone near and wide that, gosh darn it, you weren't involved in the plot. So she goes and begs on her knees and sobs uncontrollably, and then he almost exactly says it, but decides to reserve absolute proof. Understanding that Anna Scott had not seen her husband in a year and a half, understanding that Anna Scott was not about to get involved in such a ridiculous plot, because she, in fact, was good friends with James, she was exonerated, never held responsible for her husband's crimes, but there was a chance her titles could be taken away because her husband had been attainted as a treasonous man. So what she decided to do to save her titles and for her children and her children's children, she resigned her titles back to the king. And that is what preserved them. And he, understanding that she had no involvement, was able to re-grant those to her almost immediately, essentially saying that, I know she wasn't involved. You have very honestly, very humbly given them back, and I am going to give them back to you because I know you aren't involved. 3 years after her husband's death in 1685, she married again. She was still relatively young, and she and her second husband, Charles Baron Cornwallis, the Lord Admiral, he was the Lord of the Admiralty, and in fact, he was in charge of the Navy. They married in 1688. He would live until 1698 when he died. The two had three children, but only one survived to adulthood. So at this juncture, Anna Scott has two sons with Monmouth that are still surviving, and this young daughter that she had with Cornwallis. It's at this moment that we start to see her becoming more and more interested in Scotland. I think at this juncture she thought, I don't want to get married anymore. I have heirs. I've done what I need to do. And now I need to think about my heirs and their future. I need to start to think about Scotland. A tone in her writing changes in 1698 with the death of Cornwallis. She begins to be very overtly Scottish in her conversations with the people in Scotland. She talks about always being a Scottish woman and that she was dying to come home. And so if she's feeling this way in 1698, one has to wonder if she had really wanted to come home earlier. But her husbands and their responsibilities there prevented her from doing that. Now she's twice widowed. She's really free to do whatever she wants. She wants to go home. So she starts a conversation with Earl Melville, who is her factor in Scotland. And it's 1698. This is the same year Duchess Anne Hamilton resigned her titles to her son. She writes to Melville, "I thought it proper I would have put my son in see of my estate when Greem, who is one of their friends, would have given me all, would have had me give him half. But until I change my mind, I will keep all the rights I enjoy from God and my forefathers. I did not come to my estates before my time. I was my sister's heir, and I bless God I have children which I trust in his mercy will be mine when I am dead. The Duchess of Hamilton is a woman, and we are not such wise creatures as men. So I will follow no example of that sort until I see all the noblemen of Scotland resign to their sons their titles. Then I will consider the business." Isn't that great?
Yeah.
"Until all the guys do it, I'm not having anything to do with it." And a few weeks later, she goes on to say to Melville, "I'm sure you will laugh at your sister." And he was actually they were brother and sister, their brother-in-law and sister-in-law. "I'm sure you will laugh at your sister, for so I am to you. I am the man of my own family." Isn't that great? In 1698, "I am the man in my family." She knows that her oldest son is weak. He's been sick a lot during his whole life. She knows her second son is a scoundrel. And so her hope is that she's going to be able to get them married off and get some grandchildren in order to hold on to the family's holdings in Scotland. She decides to do what Anne Hamilton did, but at a much older age. She decides that she is going to invest in her family home in Scotland. This is Dalkeith House, formerly Dalkeith Castle. When it was first constructed, it was a castle, a big, ugly, black, heavy stone castle. But in 1701, she returns to Scotland with her family, and she begins the construction of this palace, because she's a duchess, she can call it a palace, on this palace in Dalkeith, Scotland, which is about 7 miles southeast of the city of Edinburgh. This was her Scottish home. And she would continue to maintain this property until she passed away in 1732. Now, she hired the same architect, James Smith, that the Hamiltons had hired. He was Scottish and known to be doing this great work all over Scotland. So that's who she wanted for the job. And he is going to design a very large property that would be very close in size to what Versailles would be. Unfortunately, family fortunes caused them to contract it very severely, but it's a wonderful place filled, as I said, with native wood and beautiful Italian marble. One of the other things that she told James Smith during the planning for the house, that she loved windows. She wanted the sun to come in, and since it doesn't shine often in Scotland, gosh darn it, I'm going to see it as often as I can. And the house is filled with lovely windows, as you can see here. On the face that is away from us, there are windows that are 3 stories tall. They're just really stunning. In 1701, she wrote to the Earl of Melville. "Some people have endeavored to make it thought I never desire to be acquainted with my own countrymen, which is not so, for I never avoided any who would be civil to me." She obviously had some fences to mend. She had not been there since she was a young child and needed to go home and reestablish herself. In addition to the lovely marble and wood, she hired very high-ranked artisans to do some of the interior work, including well-known sculptor Grinling Gibbons to do some of the sculpture in the house. She spent a lot of money, and she turned out a masterpiece. She was so unsure about going back to Scotland, she would write Melville and basically ask him, "What should I wear? I haven't been there since 1662. What do I need to bring? What kind of furniture do people in Scotland have?" She had to start all over. Until her death in 1732, she, like Anne Hamilton, continued to further her descendants' best interests by attending the Scottish business. She told one of her factors, quote, "I am happy to purchase lands either in the south of Scotland or around Dalkeith." She went on to tell him, "I thank your Lord for buying that piece of ground at Hake. 'Tis most convenient for me." However, she refused to let him farm her factor farm the lands. She thought that what she would do is take money on rents and then also coal out of the area, and that would be her income. As her life neared its end, she confided in her. You're welcome. She confided in her factor, "You are resolved to purchase half of Scotland for me." Now, just a quick side note, her descendant is the 10th Duke of Buccleuch now, and he is the number one landowner in all of the United Kingdom. He owns more than the Queen. And so the Buccleuchs have done quite well for themselves. As I thought about these two women and their really terrific, interesting lives, I saw some similarities between these two women who were contemporaries, but to the best of my knowledge, never met each other. Certainly, both women are going to ameliorate the problems of gender. They're going to very easily endure, I say easily, and I'm sure at the time it wasn't easy. They are able to get through scandals, very horrible scandals. They maintain control always of their family finances. They were Scottish through and through, and both women, we'll find out, are also opposed to union. One of the other things that I think is striking about them is that they both are going to come about their success in very different ways. One could say that Anne Hamilton, the Duchess of Hamilton, was very traditional. She married, knew that that was her responsibility, and it was with her marriage that she moved ahead. Anna Scott, the Duchess of Buccleuch, was very different. She had two interesting marriages in which both husbands manipulated her financially, and she decided that she would wait until she was a widow and then do what she knew she needed to do, reestablish the family's credibility in Scotland, so her grandson, who would actually be the one who succeeded her as well, would be able to go back to Scotland and then have his family be Scottish, not Londoners. Thank you.
Well, we have time for questions.
Are you of Scottish ancestry?
I have some. I have Stuart in me. My great-grandmother on my dad's side was a Stuart.
And like James Stuart?
It's spelled that way. I haven't tried to trace it, though. Her name was Charlotte Stuart, which is sort of this really upstanding name, and her sister was Virginia Stuart. And so I've wondered, but I haven't researched that side of the family.
Yes, back here.
How did they travel between these various locations?
By coach.
Horses?
Horses with a coach behind them. In fact, it took Anna Scott, the Duchess of Buccleuch, 2 weeks to get from London to Edinburgh.
So how long would it take to drive there now?
It would take a day of driving. It's about 4 hours to York and then another 4 hours to London, so it would take about 8 hours. You can do it in 4 hours. In plane, it's 45 minutes. So 2 weeks seems excruciating to me when I think of 21st century travel.
Back here.
How did they control finances? What kept their husbands from just ordering them to give them more and more money?
That's a good question, and one of the most powerful things is it's very difficult to get a divorce, but you can make life really difficult for your husbands by using the people that you are paying their salaries to control them. Certainly, it would be hard for her to push her husband, but she did things financially that her husband knew nothing about. In fact, she bailed out her oldest son a couple of times by giving him money after he'd lost it at the gambling table. He went ballistic, but he could only go ballistic. He couldn't do anything about it because it wasn't his money to begin with. It was her family's money.
Was it unusual for them to live into their 80s?
No.
That seems like a long lifespan.
I agree. It was extraordinarily long. Very few women lived beyond really their 50s and 60s, and so to live to be 80 was really unusual. I think it tells you how tough they were. They just weren't going to give it up.
Do you see any parallels? Interesting that you're doing this research in the time of this great Scottish referendum between Scottish patriotism then and now.
I do. One of the things that's fascinated me is the roles of the families that I researched in the Union of the Parliaments in 1707. Both sons, both Buccleuch and Hamilton, their sons were for the Union. Although the Duke of Hamilton will essentially vote no, he led the faction that was saying yes, sort of in absentia. And so knowing that these two very great families were really integral into bringing the two parliaments together has been interesting to hear people talk about the breaking up of those that parliament. The referendum, of course, was in September on the 18th, and if it had passed, it would have given Scotland complete independence and given them a parliament and their parliament's ability to levy taxes, collect taxes, and handle the whole government just like they had been doing before 1707. The referendum failed, but I know that the families of these two women were really deeply involved in it coming together.
In your research, did you find that either one of these ways had any interaction with Queen Anne or were?
Anne Hamilton did not. As she grew older, didn't want to go to London, and so she actually would send her husband to London. I've seen some of these with shopping lists, and he would bring back clothing and fabric and things. But Anna Scott, the Duchess of Buccleuch, did. She was really close with James II and his first and second wife, Anne Hyde and Mary of Modena. She was very close to William and Mary. And she was also very close to Anne, so she had interaction with all of those late Stuart kings and their families.
Yes, over here.
Back to the financial management, since they each control the purse strings, was there any documentation about them giving their husbands an allowance?
Oh, good question. I don't remember seeing that, but I haven't probed financial records. The place that I would find it probably is in the Hamilton papers, and it's a good question. It's one I should look at because I haven't probed finances very deeply, sort of on a surface. I've looked at a lot of household accounts of Anna Scott, the Duchess of Buccleuch, but I think that most of her financial accounts were kept by the factors and are in their papers, because I found very few before her return to Scotland in 1701.
Yes.
Did she do anything to keep her, either of these ladies, did they do anything to keep their daughters independent, women such as they were?
No. Well, interestingly, Hamilton's daughters married very well, and they had interesting lives. One had a rogue husband, and he got involved in some bad politics and went and lived on the continent and left her out to dry. Another daughter died young but was very much involved with her mother and politics in Scotland around the time of the Union. She died just before the vote took place. The third daughter did pretty well, but her daughter Catherine, who was married to the Duke of Athol, was very, very active in politics, but also very much like her mother. Anna Scott's daughter, with Cornwallis, lived to the 1750s, and she never married. And so I've always really wondered about why she didn't marry. Did she see the difficult life of her mother? Was it not important to try and arrange a marriage for her because Anna Scott had all these problems with her sons and trying to get them married off? It's hard for me to know, and the records are pretty quiet about why she never married.
With all these, sons, gallivants, something lacking in their education, or do you find any accounts of how they were being educated?
I'm so sorry, y'all. I'm sorry.
No worries at all. They were being educated. First, they would go to a local school. well, at least the Hamiltons. They went to a local school, and then they worked with tutors. And the tutors then took them from about age 12. At the same time, they were going to university at age 12. And then after they completed a few years at the university, then they usually went on a grand tour. The Monmouth Buccleuch children were schooled at the palace because of their relationship to Charles II. And so I'm not sure about the daughter, though. I have information about music tutors and some other tutors that girls were supposed to have. Girls didn't get the same kind of education as boys did. And so the things that I have found about her related to private tutors related to things good girls do, like dance and play music.
Any other questions? Did you want to say a little bit about the Experience Scotland program?
Sure. Yeah. One of the ways that I have come to love Scotland is through a study abroad program that I've taken students on. It's called the Experience Scotland program, and it's housed in Wisconsin. And that program is a consortium of schools there's several in Wisconsin, a couple from Minnesota, a couple from Michigan, there's one in Virginia, there's Murray State, and there's Texas Tech at Corpus Christi. And it's a residential program, and the students who participate in the program live at Dalkeith Palace, and they can go for a semester or they can go for a summer session, which are 3 weeks long. And Dalkeith, of course, is just outside of the city of Edinburgh, and so they have this great opportunity to be in sort of a country setting, a small town setting. And Dalkeith is about the same size as Murray. If you've ever been there, it's about 15,000 people. So it's easy to get to know, and then they have this really great urban experience as well. The students live, eat, and learn all at the palace. It's a complete residential program there.
Well, with that in mind, we have some people mentioned they were interested and would be traveling to Scotland. So I'd love to.
Yeah. I've been all over, and I have business cards up here if you have any questions for me, if something you think of later on and you want to send me an email. I also have some pens with Murray State History Department on them that you're welcome to take. And I even have my very own coffee mug that has a picture of the house on it, which is exciting.